You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge in their complete lineup of knives and game processing kits. These guys right now are doing an absolutely huge giveaway where you could win an elk hunt, and not just any elk hunt. We're talking about a 7 or 8 mile horseback ride into the backcountry. We're talking a one-on-one guided hunt. You're going to be sleeping in a wall tent, and you're going to be doing that for 5 days with the founder and CEO of Outdoor Edge, David Block. Now, if you've never been on an elk hunt before, I'm telling you right now, go sign up for this, because if you ever hear a elk bugle, whether it's at 400 yards or it's at 40 yards, it is a life-changing experience. So here's how you enter. Go to OutdoorEdge.com. There's going to be a big banner for it somewhere on their homepage. All you have to do is click on that. Go fill out some information. I think your name, your email address, maybe some other stuff. And that's all you have to do. That's how you are entered. They're going to be picking a winner, a ways from now. So you have plenty of time to enter. Go visit OutdoorEdge.com. Sign up today. Here we go.
Hey, folks, and welcome to the Backcountry Rookies Podcast. So I'll make the intro pretty quick here. I kind of do an intro in the beginning before we start the show. This week I've got Randy Newberg on, and it's super cool to have Randy on. I've tried to get him on here for a while, and I've finally nailed him down here right before season. So we get to talk about a lot of stuff. We talk about Randy's rookie years, and that's kind of what I wanted to really focus on this show, was the lessons that he learned early on. We talk about all that stuff, so let's just get a word from the sponsors, and then we'll jump into this show. The Backcountry Rookies Podcast is proudly brought to you by Elk 101's University of Elk Hunting. The University of Elk Hunting is the most comprehensive elk hunting education platform that you can get. From learning and knowing how to call elk to packing an elk out of the woods, University of Elk Hunting covers every step of the elk hunting process. Use the promo code ROOKIES and save $20 on your membership today. Go Hunt Insider. Go Hunt is always working hard to add value for the insiders. On top of draw odds, unit statistics and analysis, insider points in the Go Hunt gear shop, and a ton of more features, now Go Hunt is adding real 3D maps to Insider at no additional cost. Adding these maps has solved my problems of having three screens up on my computer all the time, running Insider, Google Earth, and a mapping software. Now I got them all in one place, collected right there in Go Hunt Insider. Use the code ROOKIES when you purchase Go Hunt Insider and get $50 in gear shop credit to use in the Go Hunt gear shop. Vortex Optics. Vortex designs, engineers, and produces a complete line of premium sport optics and accessories. And did you know that Vortex is now in the apparel game? So check them out, Vortex Apparel. Vortex is dedicating to providing top quality customer service and products to the users, and backs it all up with their lifetime VIP warranty. Use the code ROOKIES and save 20% off of apparel on the Vortex website. Now let's get to the show. All right. Welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies Podcast. Today, I have I've been trying to put this together for a little while, and I'm really excited about it. I've got Randy Newberg on, and we're going to touch on some topics that you don't really hear Randy talk about very often, and that is Randy's rookie years. I thought it would be really fun to bring him on here and talk about how he got started, and then more importantly, Randy knows what's coming, but I want to hear about some of those mistakes that he made as a young guy out there running around the mountains. You think, was there one or two of those out there, Randy?
I don't know how much time we have, Chad, but if you want to start talking mistakes and messed up situations, you know, we always say rookie mistake. Well, I still make quote unquote rookie mistakes. Some of them are embarrassing to think about now. It's like, did I really do that? But
I think as long as you're not still doing it, you're probably okay, right?
That's the problem. Occasionally I still do it.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. Learn from your mistakes, I guess we say.
I want to tell your audience though how patient and persistent you've been. And I really feel bad because I think that Obama was still president when you reached out to me so long ago.
Oh, again, well, it's been a while. So I'll tell you this. I'm not sure how many shows I have. Let's say 130-ish. Mm-hmm. I tried to get you as my first show. So it's been 130 show pursuit.
And I feel terrible. And I was out shooting my bow the other day, and Corey called me, Corey mm-hmm. Jacobson. And your name came up. And as quick as I got off the phone, I sent you a message and said, look, Chad, my wife is gone for the next 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I am doing nothing but dog detail. Let's get this done. So because every time I see I follow you on Instagram and I see it, I'm like, oh man, I owe that guy. Oh, I owe that guy. What? And so I appreciate your patience. I appreciate your persistence.
Well, thank you.
I don't have a good excuse, but
any excuse is as good as any, I think. I wasn't too worried about it. I know how I chased my wife around for a long time, so I know how persistence is. Dedication will get you what you want. I'm not trying to marry you though, Randy. I'm sorry. No. I'm taken.
No, the idea of being persistent and bullheaded, that is probably one of my greatest hunting attributes. Is I just don't give up.
Yeah. So, well, we're going to get to that too, I think. But let's start off with a little bit of the history of Randy. So a lot of people probably know that you're not from Western states. No. But let's talk about it. Where'd you come from? What brought you out to Montana? What got you out west and started in big game hunting?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town in northern Minnesota. Just if anyone's been to Bemidji and driven to International Falls, you went through a little wide spot in the road called Big Falls. The town when I grew up was 500 people. Now it's down to like 200. And we were all loggers, mill workers, truck drivers. You know, the beauty of everybody being from the wrong side of the tracks is nobody realizes you're from the wrong side of the tracks, because we were all from the wrong side of the track. Yeah. And everything you did was hunting, fishing, or trapping. I did not think that there was another world where people got their food from something other than hunting and fishing and gardening and foraging. And yeah, I mean, okay, you buy butter at the store, you buy milk at the store, but it was as close to subsistence as you probably were going to get in America, at least in the lower 48. And then trapping was just part of, all right, everyone needs some spending money at Christmas. So come October, November, you're out trapping mink, muskrats, red fox, or, you know, whatever you could. And it's just how I grew up. And at the time, when you grew up in a little town, you kind of kick the dirt and, oh, this little one horse town, boy, I can't wait to get out of here. So I did. I went off to the big cities to go to college and all that. Mostly because I was the worst logger in the family. My dad said, son, I'm not letting you take this over. Maybe your younger brother, but not you. You better figure out how to pay for college. So that college took me to Minneapolis, to Phoenix, and then to Reno. And along the way, I met my wife. We got married in Nevada. And we came here to Bozeman, Montana on our honeymoon because I knew my wife loved to fish. And my motive the whole time was, when I was a kid, I said, I'm moving to Montana. And you know how when you're 17 and you're sitting around your senior year, you and all your buddies are like, yeah, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I told everyone, yeah, I'm moving to Montana. And they all looked at me like, what?
What's out there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now they're all thinking, you know, that Newberg guy, he wasn't as dumb as we thought he was. So it took a while to get here. It took some big pay cuts to get here, but we moved here 1991, so almost 30 years ago. We came here on our honeymoon in 1989, and we're driving back to Nevada. And after a week of really good fishing, my wife looks at me and says, I'm moving here. You coming with? I'm like, honey, we just got married, man. I already got the ultimatum, but yeah, you damn right. My bags are packed. Let's go.
Ready to go. Yeah. I don't think anybody would argue with that for sure.
So it was really the attraction of big wild expanses of public land, another lifestyle, culture, society that's very rooted in hunting and fishing and the landscapes and clean air, clean water, the things that produce the things I love to do. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to go there. I'm going to scratch it out. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I'm going to give it my best. And so here we are 29 years later.
Doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you always, you're a pretty big public land advocate. Obviously, yep. You're a huge public land advocate.
Yeah.
Have you always been that way? Like when you were in Phoenix and Reno, were you always pushing for public land?
You know, I wasn't really an advocate at that time. I still hunted and relied on public lands. I didn't have any money. And when I moved to Montana is when I first saw a few no trespassing signs, which really didn't affect me because I was like, okay, yeah, that's private. Great. Happy for that person. You know, they probably worked hard and they own that property. They can do what they want. I'm just trucking on down to the Forest Service trailhead. But after a few years, I started thinking about how was it that I was able to go hunting growing up? Because we had public land everywhere. In northern Minnesota, it is one part of the Midwest that has tons of public land, state forests, county forests, national forests, timber company land that you were allowed to hunt. But it was just open. You know, they'd say, hey, our lands are open for hunting. And so when I started seeing some people who were not able to hunt because they didn't have access, it dawned on me how lucky I was to grow up in a place with all this public land. And I realized that I would not be a hunter today if I would have had to pay to hunt. My parents got divorced when I was 11. My mom could not have afforded a dollar a day for me to go hunting. Fortunately, I'd get off the school bus, walk down to our trailer house, grab my 20 gauge, and I'd shoot 4 or 5 grouse for dinner that night.
That's where that love began, huh?
Yeah. And it all was on public land. And so as you get older, you start realizing how lucky you are to have those situations just by coincidence. And so that's when I really started taking an interest in what public lands held for the future of hunting. And I'd say my first jump into the politics pool of it was in 1994. I'd only been here a few years. In Montana, we have 5.3 million acres of state trust land that's held by our state land board. And at the time, we were not allowed to hunt state lands, just like Colorado right now. Even today, you can't hunt state trust lands. And the legislature's in session and they kind of, you know, the call is made, hey, if you like to hunt, show up because we're going to push this bill where for a $10 fee, you can buy a permit that allows you to hunt these state lands. And I'm thinking, wow, 5 million more acres to hunt. I'll be there. So it's tax season. I'm a CPA in my other life at this time. I tell my boss, hey, I'm taking the day off. I'm going to Helena. This is important to me. And so from that point on, it's just me and my big mouth. A lot of people ask me, well, how did you end up being the person who's always asked to speak? When I was in high school, I was captain of the football team my junior and senior year, and so I had to give the high school the homecoming speech. I just about wet my pants. I hated public speaking so bad. So when I was in college in Reno, I said, you know what, I got to get over this. So I took 2 years of business and professional speaking. And so now for me to get up in front of a crowd of however many thousands of people and just tell stories or, you know, give a presentation doesn't faze me at all. And so that's really how, you know, most hunters are loners or just, you know, they don't want to be the spotlight. And I don't really want to be the spotlight either. But if we need somebody who's good at this or somebody who's good at that, I guess if I'm good at public speaking, all right, I'll get up and deliver the message. And make a fool of myself. But so that's kind of how my advocacy started. And by 98, 99, I was going back to DC and doing stuff and just involved in all kinds of conservation groups, volunteering, nonprofit groups. And thought, you know what? I took a huge pay cut to come here and enjoy these public lands of the Northern Rockies. I am not going to stand by and let them be impaired or other sold or traded or whatever, unless it's for the benefit of hunting and fishing and outdoor access. So, and my wife was all in. She's like, look, I'll stay at home. I'll watch our son. You go to these meetings and you give them hell.
She wanted all that good fishing, all right. The good fishing access, didn't she?
Yeah. So yeah. Even though I'm the blowhard spokesman of the group, she was there behind the scenes, kind of like she is today with a lot of our stuff. Go get them, Randy. I'll take care of this. You go get them. So
that's good. That's good.
It's a blessing. I always tell people I was born into the greatest country in the world, and I set out every day to prove that to be true.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm blessed to have a wife that is, I mean, you know, you hear the saying, you know, you both got to be rowing the same direction or the boat spins in circles.
Yeah.
And she is. I can't even tell you how lucky I am to have someone who supports the same things I do, doesn't want to be in the spotlight at all, but says, I'll do whatever I got to do to help you do it.
Yeah, so. That's super cool. Is that where you're living in Phoenix? Were you able to hunt coos deer out there then? Or were you into hunting that much back then?
I was really into hunting, but I found out they had quail and dove. So
yeah, that kind of took over there.
I enrolled at Arizona State, and a lot of people say, oh, you attended Arizona State? And I have to correct them. I said, no, I enrolled. My attendance sucked. Yeah. Because I worked in the morning, and then every afternoon we'd go to this little town that's now just an extension of Phoenix. It's called Maricopa. Mm-hmm. And we would hunt doves. If dove season was open, that's what we'd do. And then on the weekends, we'd really splurge. We'd go to Wickenburg and hunt quail. Yeah. Well, I really got carried away to the point where I got put on academic probation. I transferred to Arizona State. I'm on the dean's list before I get there. And within 2 years, I'm on academic probation. Because of my hunting problems.
That's funny. Hunting problems. is there a support group for that somewhere?
I needed one. I tell you what, if there was a 12-step program for hunting recovery, I was going to be patient number one.
That's funny. That's funny. So then where did the Western big game bug come from? Obviously, I guess, you know, being in Montana is probably where it started, but yeah. How did it all begin?
Well, It began in Minnesota. My dad, he had serious struggles with alcohol, and that's part of why my parents got divorced. But if there was one time in the year he and I could have some semblance of a normal relationship, it was deer season. And in Minnesota, deer season's a big deal. It's 2 weeks of everybody just shut her down and head north, and we happen to be up north. We were the epicenter of part of the deer hunting. And so I was attracted to hunting as a little kid. I was the oldest child in my family. I was the oldest grandson that was around. So I got invited by the uncles and grandparents to go join deer camp and all this stuff. And so I really, really enjoyed it. They treated me so special. And it became the one time of the year where my dad and I could have a normal relationship. And so I think hunting, as much as it was fun out in the woods, for me, it represented kind of that, I don't want to say fantasy, but it represented an alternate life, different than the struggles that I saw my dad going through and that were affecting our relationship. So I always loved big game hunting. There it was all whitetails. Mm-hmm. But I dreamed that someday I'm going elk hunting. I'm going to win the lottery and I'm going to be able to afford an elk hunt. And I want to go with those buggy eyed blackhorn pronghorn things. Man, those look cool. Or, you know, mule deer to a whitetail guy, you see these big mule deer racks and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I got to go do that. And so my dad was really into bear hunting. That was his other big thing. They only have a fall bear season in Minnesota, but he would set out bait stations and then people would come and hunt over them. And I hauled so much bear bait as a teenager. I just grew to hate bear hunting. Everything about it. Most of the people who'd come in up and hunt over his bait, they didn't want the meat. And my dad was one of these utilitarian guys where nothing's going to waste. So, oh yeah, I'll take your meat. I'll take your meat. Well, we had freezers full of bear meat. And I did not shoot my first black bear until 2009, 5 years after my dad had passed away.
Wow.
And then when I did it, I still remember that hunt. It's pretty memorable to me because when your father or mother passes away, you start having these, you know, memories, and in your mind, you're sorting out the good memories from the bad memories. Then I started to understand my dad's infatuation with bears. And so now I do a lot of spring bear hunting. I like the spot and stock part of black bear hunting, and that's why I do it in the spring, and I don't do it over bait. I mean, I have no problem with people hunting over bait, and my family does it, and that's the way you do it in northern Minnesota.
Is it legal in Montana to bait bears?
You can't bait bears here. You can in Idaho. I think you can in Wyoming. But you get way more exercise, and it's a good reason to get out in the springtime after tax season. So the whole big game thing, I kind of came by birth. My dad's dad was a big hunter. My mom's dad was a big hunter. My mom has six brothers. They were all big hunters. So it wasn't whether or not I was going to be a hunter. It was going to be, how old will it be before I get my shotgun, or before I get a 22 or a 30-30 or something? That just carried with me. And that is why I wanted to move to Montana. I understood how much opportunity was in the Rockies. It could have been Montana. It could have been Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, who knows. But it's been there since the beginning.
Yeah. And I think that's why you're such an excellent spokesperson for big game hunting and Western hunting, because this was my attraction to the Western hunting. I'm from Indiana originally, and the only real hunting that I knew was Indiana's mostly private. There's some public out there, but there's not a lot. And I just remember as a kid going around and knocking on doors with my dad and him trying to get permission to be able to go put up a stand, you know, and we can hunt whitetails out of a stand. But there wasn't any of that public land access that you promote on through your Fresh Tracks, you know, and all of your TV and YouTube stuff. And so I remember I watched one of your Fresh Tracks videos, and I don't remember exactly which one it was, but there's only a few of them out there, right? So, but I watched one, and it just so happened it was one of the ones where you're talking about access and being able to just, these are our public lands, right? And let's utilize it. And I was so taken by that, like, oh my God, this is a reality, right? Like I could actually go out west and do it. And that's kind of where all of my interest started with. It was just understanding, because I think a lot of people that hunt those Texas, for example, I talked to so many people in Texas that they go west for hunting because hunting is hard and it's very expensive in Texas. If you want to hunt an elk in Texas, you're in the five figures for sure to get a good bull, you know?
Yep. I thought growing up in Minnesota, where I got most of my hunting media consumption that allowed me to learn about the bigger world beyond my little town was the hunting magazines that came to our school library. I'd read Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, Sports of Field, Fur Fishing Game. I'd read them start to finish on study hall. I started reading about all these opportunities that were out here, but most of those articles were with an outfitter. And so you'd look in the back and it said, you know, $1,200 for an elk hunt. I'm like, I'll have to rob a bank to ever go elk hunting. And then when I moved out here and I realized how doable it was and how much time I spent doing it with very bad success, once I started figuring it out and having some success, that's when the idea came to me that, you know what, there are a lot of other Randy Newbergs out there growing up in a Big Falls, Minnesota kind of place who don't know that you could come and do this. how do I help them understand that they can come and do this? If you're willing to hunt public land and you're willing to hunt hard and you're willing to save a little bit of money for your tags and licenses, this is within your reach. I was wrong to think that you had to hire an outfitter and rob a bank or win the lottery. And so that's
Attainable for sure. I was just texting with one of my younger cousins who is still in Indiana, and he was saying here in a couple of years he wants to come out, and we were texting back and forth, and I said, man, just do it, set the plan and do it, start saving a couple bucks a month, or you know, a little few more than that, but we'll get you out here and we'll get you out and playing around in the mountains. So you mentioned earlier about sucking at hunting when you first started, I think, or maybe you said you were bad or sucked or whatever. I can't remember. So let's get down to it. Let's talk to those early years of Randy Newberg and some of the mistakes that were made, because I really think there's, to me, it's funny. I started this whole podcast, the Rookies, with the idea of everybody's got to start somewhere, right? Everybody's a rookie at one point in time.
Yep.
And people aren't just out there slaying elk left and right their first year. There's some lucky ones, of course, but what were some of those mistakes that you made in those early years?
Oh, man.
I know you said there's a ton. We'll touch on some of the majors.
I don't know that it was a mistake. It was a misconception that really caused me to struggle at elk hunting. Is I was always worried, what if I shot one in a foils because I can't drag it out to the trailhead. So for years, I hunted closer to roads and trailheads because I was worried about if I ever get lucky and do shoot one, I can hardly drag a 200-pound whitetail or mule deer out of the woods. How am I going to drag a 600-pound bull elk out of the woods? Because I did not grow up in a culture or a place where you ever quartered anything out, where you boned it out. And that was such foreign knowledge to me that I probably spent my first 3 years of elk hunting in places where, just by my concern of the ethics for the meat, I'd eliminated the likelihood of having success. I had not invested in the information and knowledge needed to take care of an elk if I got one down. So my workaround to that was, well, I'll just hunt closer to roads and trails, which in some highly restricted areas, some places that are just about impossible to draw, you'll get elk near roads and trails. And occasionally someone will shoot one near a road or trail. But highly pressured elk on public land, they figure that out real quick, and your odds just get really low. So that was probably my first mistake, was to, rather than teach myself and learn how to take care of an elk in bits and pieces if I got one on the ground, stick with the old attitude of I'll drag it out like I do a deer. And you just, even downhill with snow, you're not doing that. So that was probably my biggest mistake. My other mistakes were all, I would say, based on my background as a whitetail hunter. In northern Minnesota, you know, a whitetail has a home range of maybe a square mile, if that even, in farm country. You know, oh, that 80-acre patch holds 4 bucks. Not here, not with elk, not with huge, big, vast expanses of land. And so I was intimidated by how big the landscape was of, well, how do I pick this spot versus that spot? I floundered because I did not understand that an animal that moves across the landscape to the degree that elk do is moving across that landscape with a purpose. It's not random. It's not by accident. And I did not invest enough in my knowledge of elk to know where they're going to be on purpose on that landscape. I just thought, well, if I walk enough miles, I'll bump into one. Yeah, you might.
A lot of miles.
Yeah. And you're counting on random luck, and that's pretty fickle. So I think my lack of and I was also at the time going through this idea that okay, I'm making a little more money, a little more money. My disposable income for hunting gadgets is growing each year. If I buy a few more gadgets and gizmos, I don't have to invest in my elk knowledge. I'll find a shortcut. Well, what I came to learn after 6 years of not filling an elk tag is there were no shortcuts. You either got lucky and you thought that was a shortcut, but it hard to repeat good luck, right? Who gets really lucky year after year after year? Not very many people.
Not very many, yeah.
So that's probably, you know, being rooted in the whitetail of thinking that elk were in this small place or that they were just randomly across the landscape when that's not the case, were probably the biggest hurdles or the places where I set myself up for the greatest failures. So
were those resources available back in that time frame? Like now there's Corey's University of Elk Hunting, which is phenomenal. Right. And you have a section on there for your late season type of stuff. And there's so many other resources out there. Was that available then?
No. You could buy a book and it would be one guy talking about his elk hunting experience, and he is usually a very accomplished elk hunter, but he might hunt the thick timber of northern Idaho. Okay. How applicable is that to Arizona? You might find another book or some articles. I mean, this was before Al Gore invented the internet. So we're sorry to say that. I just it comes out without even trying.
I laugh every time I hear it too.
The number of people who get mad at me for that joke, now I almost say it to see, well, I wonder how many people get mad at me. Yeah. So you were taking bits and pieces. And the breakthrough for me was after my sixth year, I told my wife, I said, you know what? I am killing an elk next year, no matter what. And she kind of rolled her eyes like, well, you've said that for the last 4 years. But so I sat down one summer and I'm thinking, all right, I can go to just about any lake, any reservoir, any river, and I can catch walleyes just about any time of the year. Why can I be so successful on something that people say is a rather hard fish to catch, but if for the life of me, I can't find a bull elk. So I spent the whole summer thinking and analyzing, and I came to the conclusion that I knew what walleyes were doing at all times of the year. Okay. I know they have their cold water period when it's frozen. I know they have their pre-spawn period. I know they have their spawn period. I know they have post-spawn. They have midsummer and late summer patterns. And I know that they are moving around the lake or reservoir or the river during each of those periods because they have a different need. So I took that and I applied it to elk hunting. I said, all right. And that's where you've heard me talk about my five periods of calendar periods of elk hunting. Mm-hmm. All right. There's an early season, a pre-rut, peak rut, post-rut, late season. And so I kind of did this. I had these sheets where I was writing everything down. All right. What are their needs in each of those periods? And so it took me a while to sort out, talking to a ton of biologists, what's the primary need of an elk? Well, every one of them would answer slightly different, but they all fell into three categories: food, water, and security or sanctuary. And some would say, well, breeding in September. So I came up with, those are the four needs. Here are the five periods. The elk are going to be somewhere on this landscape, just like those walleyes are. They're in a certain depth at a certain water temperature at a certain time of year because they can satisfy their need in that location with the least amount of risk. So if I apply that to elk, where are they going to be at this time of year when I have my tag? So I get all excited. It was before I started archery hunting. And I tell my wife, I'm going to sleep at the trailhead down here south of town. I know this is where they're going to be. They're in this post-rut period. They need sanctuary. And they're going to have just dispersed from the cows. I think they're going to be in this area. And this is back when you had, you know, topo maps, like paper maps. Mm-hmm. And
what's that?
Yeah. So I get up. There's nobody at the trailhead yet. I walk in. I probably walked in at 2 a.m. I sat out there waiting for the sun to come up forever. And I'm sitting there, no elk. All right. The hunting pressure just hasn't moved them to a sanctuary yet. That's in my mind. Well, there's always this big flat rock that I'd walk by in the past when I'd do my random walking through the woods. And I thought, oh man, that's a nice rock. I bet you it's warming up in the sun this morning. I lay down on that rock and I start falling asleep and I hear a bugle. I'm like, is that an elk or is that another hunter? Ah, it's got to be another hunter. And then I hear, and this trail that I thought led down into this sanctuary, here comes a cow. Now I'm getting ready. I get my 270 up there, and here comes this bull walking right behind her, 40 yards from me. It would have been a perfect archery shot. And he turns and he looks at me, and boom, shot my first elk opening morning after spending the whole summer building this guideline of how to analyze this. Next year, shot another bull. Next year, shot another bull. I was like, why did I make this so hard?
Yeah.
And so since then, I've used that. I know it's not science. It's just how simplified I have to make things. And finding bull elk on public land has become a lot easier. It's still a challenge, but it's become way easier. And I've found that the more time I spend in finding elk, the more elk I find. And the number one reason I usually don't fill a tag is I didn't do my research about where will I find those elk on those public lands at the time I have my tag.
And it's not really a theory, I guess. That method applies. It doesn't just apply to Montana. That whole idea is every state in the West, because they need those core things. That they have to have them in order to survive. So it works everywhere.
Yeah. And so from that, I became a voracious reader and researcher about elk information. I realized after about 3 years of that methodology working for me, I realized how big of a gap I had in my elk knowledge. That buying the new spray or the new whistle or the new rifle, none of that was going to fill in those gaps of elk knowledge. Well, why did I have such success walleye fishing? Because I'd been walleye fishing from the time I was 2 years old. I just, through osmosis, through being there, living it, I came to understand, well, in the springtime, you fish walleye shallow. And so there's so many things you learn when you're immersed in a culture of that's what you do compared to coming to it green. And so I came to elk hunting green as green gets. And so this whole process showed me how important it was. And I still do this today. I subscribe to so many journals, so many sites. I'm Googling all the time any new article about elk, elk forage, range conditions. How do elk respond to this? How do elk respond to fires? And there's state universities. There's the Forest Service. There's the BLM. There's state wildlife agencies. These studies are happening all the time, and I read them all. Any of them I can get my hands on. You ask me to read a book, yeah, I'll buy it on Audible and I'll love listening to it, because I find my mind drifting away and I'm like, oh, I got to go reread that. You give me some scientific article about elk, I'll read it start to finish and I'll be paying close attention. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I've had to do it. You know, some people probably grew up in elk country and it's just intuitive to them. It was not intuitive to me. And so whenever I can invest more in myself and my knowledge, I'm doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent approach for sure. I think you are right too. There's some people that just grew up in it and there were probably like you and bear hunting with your dad or, you know, fishing or whitetail hunting or whatever. It just kind of came natural. And then you got clowns like me, they're mid 40s and trying to get started in this thing. And there is a lot to figure out. And you mentioned it earlier too about the vast land and how big it is. I also think that's something that's underestimated by people.
Yeah.
That was a rookie mistake for me, was taking for granted the size of those of the mountains. My first day driving up to the trailhead in Colorado was,
I looked up like, there is no way I'm getting to the top of that. There is no way it's happening. We got there, but it took a long time to get up there and a lot of deep, short breaths. But yeah. Sorry, I kind of went off a little
bit. No, I'm with you. The first time I was looking at a map and saying, well, where am I going to go? It was so intimidating. I think I'd like the sound of that creek. That sounds like a cool creek. I'm going to go up that drainage.
There's probably elk right there, I bet.
Yeah, the elk probably know the name of that creek. They think it's a cool sounding name just like I do. They'll be there.
Yeah.
Well, no. So I tried all kinds of random things with no success, but it was intimidating. And I think one of the things I learned from that process is the less knowledge you have, the easier you'll be intimidated. The easier you're intimidated and frustrated, the more you fall back on, well, I hope I get lucky today. And for what we do, you know, we're out doing this year, I've got 5 elk tags. I'm helping a bunch of other people with their elk hunts. I can't rely just on good luck. We've got 5 days. I tell people we show up, we hunt for 5 days, usually in a place we've never been to before. We have 5 days to sort it out, figure it out, pack it out. And when we show up, we got to be dialed in. We got to have our research done. All right. Is this a late season hunt? Okay. They're in a sanctuary pattern. All right. In the sanctuary, are they going to be at the sanctuaries on the upper end of their transition range, or are they going to be in the sanctuaries closer to the winter range? So there's all of this kind of forks in the road, just analysis that we go through. And every little tidbit that I can gather along the way from a biologist, a researcher, a game warden, whoever it is.
The guy at the supermarket.
I try my best to have more knowledge so that I don't get in that position where I feel like I haven't done my homework and therefore I'm just relying on luck.
Yeah. So
my outcomes of relying on luck have not been that good.
Yeah, well, I've got a few years under my belt too. That there's no, you don't see any elk antlers hanging back here, right? So we'll see. This is the year. This is the year. Yeah. So what's changed? I think that's big too. We talked a little bit about some of the knowledge and stuff that's out there, but from the time that you got started, how's it become easier and what's changed to make it better?
I think our equipment obviously has come miles and miles. You look at clothing. Okay. When I first started elk hunting, I wore all my wool from back home in Minnesota. You know, everyone hunted in wool. It was quiet. It would retain heat even if it got wet. Well, guess what? It also is really heavy. I use that as an example. The optics we have, the firearms, the bows, all of that is definitely given us an advantage. Our vehicles, whether they're all-terrain vehicles or our trucks, you know, my dad went to his grave never owning a four-wheel drive, and he hunted a lot. Well, chain her up and get the handyman jack. Gotta come along. And then along comes ATVs and side-by-sides. But then I think the biggest thing has just been the ability to share knowledge. I get a lot of grief. People say, Newberg, I can't believe you spend so much time throwing all this out there for the public. Let them figure it out. And I get that some people say that, but that's the why of my business model. If you want to call it a business model, I don't make, I haven't taken a paycheck yet. So maybe it's my nonprofit model, is to promote self-guided public land hunting and create advocates for that cause. Well, my theory is if we're going to create advocates for hunting public land and the conservation of those lands, they need some touch points that are positive. And not everybody's as bullheaded as I am to spend 6 years plowing through this. So yeah, I share a lot of information. I don't share specific units or waypoints or anything like that, but I share these ideas like I just talked to you about, these 5 calendar periods of elk hunting, the needs, the little bits and pieces that I think help people find elk. And so with all of that, you're going to use the technologies that are available for sharing information. Like I own a really big hunting forum called hunttalk.com. We use YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. You know, here you and I are doing a podcast and we're 1,000 miles apart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ability to share information, mapping technology, you know, OnX came out with the first digital map chips. Mm-hmm. And now we've got OnX, we've got Go Hunt, we've got all kinds of competitors that are doing maps. So there's just information out there and tools that improve our success that make it easier. There's no substitute for knowledge and hard work, but every one of these little things incrementally help us become slightly more successful. Maybe it makes it more comfortable to be out in the hills because you have better boots or a better pack. So the more you're out in the hills, the greater your likelihood of having success. Or it allows you to hunt in some really adverse conditions. I mean, my Sitka gear compared to what I had at the time when I first started elk hunting, there were some really miserable days out there when I first started.
Now my
level of physical discomfort due to climatic or environmental conditions is almost zero. So it allows me to stay out there more, feel safer, more confident. And the more I'm out there, the greater the likelihood that I'm going to encounter an elk. So
yeah,
it's a whole lot of things, but
I agree with you. And the knowledge I think is, it really is phenomenal. Just some of the websites that are out there and those hunt talk, like your Hunt Talk forum, there's just information shared.
Yeah.
Most people I think in this industry are willing to help. And that, I think that's one thing that I really enjoy about this industry. They're mm-hmm. not going to help you in the sense of, we'll go to this unit, here's a waypoint, I've killed a bull there the last 3 years, but they're going to help in the sense that maybe they'll help guide you in the direction. And I think it's great. So just camaraderie, community is probably a better word than camaraderie, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I get excited when I see new hunters have success. I'm 55. I've been hunting now for over 40 years. You know, my first deer hunt was in 1976. So what's that? 44 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if I never take another animal again, I've taken more than my share. So what can I give back in terms of my advocacy, my time, and sharing of information? That's, you know, Larry D. Jones, Corey Jacobson and I had him on a podcast. And we told him, Larry, you know, when you and Dwight Chu started doing all this, did you guys get a lot of grief? And Larry just started laughing. He said, oh yeah, we were going to be the end of elk hunting because we were teaching people how to call elk and we mm-hmm. were teaching people about thermals and stuff like that. And Corey and I looked at each other and just started laughing. And we told Larry, said, well, we get the same criticism. He's like, yeah, you know, thankfully you guys like you come along and now I'm no longer the guy who's ruining the world of elk hunting.
Yeah, he's not the enemy now.
Yeah, he said, but someday when you're old like me, there'll be somebody in your shoes and they'll be the reason that elk hunting went to hell in a handcart. And but I accept those, you know, those people, and we try to balance it. We do our best to do what you say. Give people the skills to create their own success. The old, what's the saying, you know, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach him mm-hmm. to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. That kind of the same principle applies, is we want to teach people how do you find elk? Not where, but how. Because if we say, oh, this waypoint, well, there were elk there last week, but they're probably not there next week. And so have you learned anything from that? Nope. So, but yeah, I'm interested to see who the next generation is that's going to come along and lead, you know, this public land advocacy stuff. There's so many great leaders in it right now. It's exciting to see the advocacy for public lands at this point. When I started, so a little background, this room right behind me here, 2005, I come home from the Mayo Clinic. I've got this really bad liver condition. At that time, they couldn't diagnose it, couldn't control it. Now it's much better, but I said, you're really sick. You're going home and laying on the couch for 3 months. Like, whoa, I'll be divorced. My wife, she can't put up with me for 3 months. Yeah. So my son and I are playing cribbage, and I'm watching way too much outdoor TV, which is not the least bit therapeutic. And I tell my son, I said, you know, this, what a bunch of crap. This is, none of us hunt that way. None of us, there's no public land. It's all with guides, and nothing wrong with that. I've been on guided hunts, had a blast. I've hunted private land. I've had a blast, but I knew that there is a disconnect between 100% of the media showing these kind of hunts and the fact that 90% of hunters hunted like I did. So, and my son, he's kind of the confident young guy, says, well, we could do better than them. I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm on the couch and they're on TV. So he convinces my wife to order every kind of piece of video equipment, camera you can think of. And we're going to go out and start filming public land hunts, filming self-guided hunts. So that's how it all started in 2005. My son talked me into it. Yeah. And so we do this. We film friends and family, and they film us. And so he puts together this sizzle reel. I go to the SHOT Show in January of 2007, and I get laughed out of the place. Public land without guide? Good luck with that.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm really bullheaded, so I go back to the SHOT Show in January of 2008, got a more polished sizzle reel, got a better sales pitch, get lined up to a few of these companies, and pretty much every ad agency, every supposed expert kind of pats you on the back. Good luck with that public land thing. Well,
I think it worked out.
Yeah, here we are. And
I think it worked out really well for you.
It was just a business plan that I put together that said, well, in the West, 70% of hunters hunt public land. But there wasn't one Western show that was exclusively public land. So as an accountant, I'm like, that looks like a business opportunity. And it's right in my wheelhouse because I spend all this time working on land exchanges and conservation easements and volunteering. I'm going to try to make a go of this. And my wife's like, give her hell.
Yeah.
I'm here when you're done. So it's really exciting for me to see how many people also have that same passion for public land as we do, and how many people are advocating for it. I mean, today public land's a pretty damn big deal.
And yeah,
I love seeing that.
It's a huge deal.
Yeah. So
how many, that first couple of years that you were doing filming, how many hunts were you guys filming compared to now? Because now you're doing, what'd you say, you have just 5 elk tags. What else do you have besides elk?
Nevada deer, Arizona deer, Montana deer, Wyoming deer. I'll have Montana black bear in the spring. And then I'm going to go help a bunch of people. So, yeah, that first season, I think we filmed 8 hunts.
Okay.
We were on Outdoor Channel. And then we did a spring bear hunt. So that was our 9th. And then you had to deliver at least 10 episodes. So the 10th episode was always best of, which we didn't have a lot of good stuff. So
that first bear hunt that you video or that you recorded, did you get any fallback from that? Cause it seems like bear, I hear it a lot. I think now it's becoming publicized a little bit more, but it seems like there's something around a bear that people just don't.
Yeah, the bears our number one negative commented video on YouTube is an Alaska bear hunt from 2013. There's definitely a stigma about bear hunting. Me, I never understood it because I grew up, I ate more bear meat than I did whitetail meat.
Right.
And so it's like, why do you care if I'm eating a bear, a pig, a cow, a deer, whatever, an animal died so I can eat? So to me, that was always this, what the hell is going on here? People don't eat bears. It was like, people eat bear all the time where I grew up. So yeah, it got a lot of flack, but I, you know, and then in 2012, we did the first wolf hunt ever aired on TV.
Yeah.
Now, if you want a lot of love letters. All it takes is for the New York Times to pick up on a story that, hey, you know, there's, for the first time ever, there's going to be this wolf hunt aired on Sportsman Channel. Oh my gosh. It was crazy.
Love or hate, I'm sure. One or the other, right?
Oh, yeah. A lot of hate. And then there's a group called the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. They sent out this press release with a lot of my contact information. So full of BS, but, you know, it fit the narrative. And they have this big network of people that are foreigners. Well, Europeans do not have any understanding of conservation and wildlife management in the States. And so the number of people who were coming to kill my dogs and burn my house down, and it's just like out of hand. It's like, it became so humorous. I started posting some of them on my Hunt Talk forum. And what these people don't know is there are tools where you can scan an email to get the IP address right down to the street location. So I knew where these were coming from. But what do you do? You know, I just, my wife, she's at first was a little bit unnerved, like, well, you're gone a lot and these crazies are going to show up. And, you know, I just accept it as part of what I do. I don't make a big deal out of it. If I were to do a social media post every time I got a piece of hate mail or a threat or whatever, that I'd have to start my own Instagram channel just for all the love letters I get.
Yeah, right.
You know, I say take a number and stand in line because there's a lot of people in front of you waiting for a piece of my ass. So.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people that support it 100% too. Yeah. And I think there's probably more of those than there is the ones that are wanting a piece of that. So,
yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time, Randy. Before I let you go, you got any another tip or two that you want to throw out to rookie hunters?
You know, I in today's world, here, if there's one thing about hunting becoming so accessible via media, at my time when I was younger, it was all print media. And then this network called the Nashville Network, TNN, started having some hunting and fishing shows on a cable network. Well, now today with TV, with social media, with YouTube, with, you know, all these platforms, one of the things I worry about is that people are putting too much pressure on themselves because what they see is success after success. Every week, this person kills a bigger buck. And that is why we, by design, show all of our unsuccessful hunts. We want people to know that the real value in hunting is the food, the family, the friendships, being involved in conservation, being connected to this natural world, and take it for that. Don't take it for what somebody else makes of it. Don't put pressures on yourself that, this is the expectation. No, if anything, I'm on this crusade, this mission to bust the myths, the kind of debunk the common misconceptions or pressures that somehow you got to shoot a bigger buck every year. This year, in fact, when I go to Idaho, I'm hoping I get to shoot a cow elk.
Yeah,
I want to shoot a cow elk because right now my freezer's bare. And last night I ate the last piece of moose meat that was in my freezer. And for me, hunting, I came to hunting through food. And I think a lot of people are coming to hunting through food. And I think a lot of people have come to hunting through food, no matter what culture you come from. And I worry that in our media blitz that we have, that we're getting away from that. We're getting away from being storytellers. As hunters, we've been storytellers since we sat around the caves of France 12,000 years ago and etched our story on a rock.
Yeah.
If you look at other cultures in Africa, the northern plains of the United States, hunting was also, what did the native tribes paint on their teepees? Stories of the hunt. Mm-hmm. What did they paint on their garment? Stories of the hunt. Hunters have always been storytellers, and they're stories we tell about the amazing animals, the landscapes, the successes, the failures, And so that's what we try to craft our message with.
I wonder if Native Americans' fish stories were bigger.
I'm going with yes, they were.
I think so.
And so, but what I'd want to leave people with is hunting is an amazing activity. It's an amazing part of our culture and who we are. Accept it for what it is. Don't put any artificial expectations in there. Don't deny yourself the absolute privilege and wonders of going out, having a day where you don't feel a tag, and realizing that was really a great day. And I know that's kind of my mission these days, is to be the antithesis of some of the things that worry me.
Yeah, there's a lot of joy that comes in, for me at least. Some of the people, I think, maybe put a lot of pressure on themselves for that. But just being outside and out in the wilderness and just enjoying it. And I was telling my wife the other day, I went for a hike here in New Mexico, and I got up to, up pretty high, and the sun was starting to come up and all those pine trees were heating up. And just the smell, just being out there was so awesome. And that, to me, that was, I mean, I like to bring home some meat too, but
yeah,
being out was pretty amazing.
Yeah,
that's part of it for me. That's a big part.
And I said it earlier, we live in the greatest country in the world. We're blessed beyond what we even come, we don't even come close to understanding how blessed we are. Go out there and appreciate it, because it's not to be taken for granted. And put a smile on your face, put your pack on your back, and the chips are going to fall where they may. Some days you're going to work really hard and you don't have anything to show for it. And then some days it's just going to fall on your lap and you're going to say, I didn't really deserve this, but I'll take it.
Yeah. Shoot a bowl in camp, right?
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah. And just realize how truly blessed we are.
Yeah.
And if that should put a smile on everybody's face.
Yeah, and you mentioned that shoot a cow elk too. I think that's pretty cool. Corey is adding, or just added, a section. Did you write that, or did
it? No, he and I have been talking about it, and we're going to expand on it.
So he was talking about that, and we had my partner Jordan. He drew an elk or a cow elk tag. He put in for it. That's what he wanted. Yeah. And I was like, well, I got a bull tag. Why didn't you put in for a bull tag? And he's like, there's a whole lot more cows running around out there.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And here in Montana, I can get a whitetail doe B tag, which I have. I can get a region-wide whitetail doe tag. And I go out every year, and I'm tipping over those does, and we're eating them, man. Kate, who lives across the street here, her and her husband Dick used to hunt. And they're in their 80s now. And I always tell her, if ever you need meat, part of the purpose why I go out here and do these does is because I know people who, they really appreciate it when I can give them meat. And if I'm going to share meat, I'm not going to share that skanky old rutted up buck. Okay. If someone wants quality meat, those white-tailed does, man, I'm on those like a rat on a Cheeto. Just let me at them, and I make no apologies, and I love eating them. So it brings me back full circle. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I wrote an article. I don't know, are you familiar with the publication The Modern Huntsman?
No, not familiar now.
Okay. They asked me to write a story about camps, deer camps. And so I did. And all the stories were about these wonderful traditions. And it kind of goes back to growing up in Minnesota and how my dad's deer camp fell apart because of his drinking and a bunch of other things. And how now having camps. So I do this camp in Southern Arizona every year, invite friends. I do a camp in Montana, invite friends. And those bring me back to those special memories. There, the innocence of, if there's one of the things I think we find beauty in the innocence of younger hunters, is they are there strictly for the beauty of the hunt, the connection, the natural world, all the things that are at its basic level. And so these kind of camps and stuff bring me back there, because I'm 5 years old, I think it was. My first real memory is my dad bringing a white-tailed deer and plopping it down on our kitchen table. And he's getting ready to convert this to meat. Well, to me, these were always these white-tailed things that with the big eyes that ran around in the woods. And I'm standing there at about eye level with this little buck laying there on the table, tongue out, its eyes now going from that, have went from the bright brown to now that bluish green. And he's carving on it. And the very first strip that he cuts out are the tenderloins in, in the cavity. And he hands them to my mom. She walks over to the stove and she is cooking this stuff. And it was right then where the light went on that this is where my food comes from. And I can envision that like it was yesterday. And it just continues to bring me back to hunting for food and the responsibility, the fulfillment that I get for hunting and securing my own food is a feeling I never want to lose. And we're so blessed to be able to go do that in this country that I hope everyone goes and does it.
I do too. That Arizona camp, that's a lot of fun down there. That's just the perfect time of year. It's like the perfect spot to be. Evening fires, throwing some backstrap on that nice evening fire. It's great down there. Very good. Well, I'll let you go, Randy. I really do appreciate your time, and I'm glad we finally linked up and got this recorded.
Thank you, Chad. I appreciate all you do, and thanks for being a voice. Your maturity in all this and just your leadership in it is greatly appreciated. And I just hope that it's not as long before we get to spend an actual camp together.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll share that dilly bar we talked about earlier when you come through Albuquerque, and we'll start with dilly bars and go from there.
All right. Thanks for having me, Chad.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Yep.